Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned in to The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics, government, and selfishness went wrong, and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of insight, aimed at making each of us more responsible, more cooperative, and more aware of the spiritual bonds that connect us to each other, no matter what we find to squabble over in the interim. You can call us toll-free from the U.S. to 877-876-5227. You can call us from Canada to 888-810-8322, or you can call direct to 530-876-3222. Now, this show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, just contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show can be found on the BBS Radio site and at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows become available as soon as it is humanly possible, or even extra humanly possible, on the station archives. And now, my personal blog is located at howtheneoconstolefreedom.blogspot.com, and the blog at the top this week is titled, Mom, is George Bush a Terrorist? My son asked a question. I answered it. The answer has caused comments, so if you have time, do give it a read. The article takes you into the scary convergence of what Bush Company have planned for us, the place where their creative writing exercises, for instance, the most recent round of executive orders, that sounds so official and inoffensive, doesn't it, meets the building of jail cells. Honk, if Bush says you're a terrorist, is a bumper sticker I expect to see appearing soon. And regarding the presidential parade of unbeauty queens we're all watching now, in the week just past, Ms. Hillary was accused by Dick Morris of amazingly unsavory activities. Morris cites an article that appeared in the New York Post on May 24th. Here's the front end of the article. Quote, since he left office in 2001, former President Bill Clinton has been paid by InfoUSA, an Omaha, Nebraska company that has been identified as a key provider of specially designed databases that are sold to criminals who use the detailed information to defraud the unsuspecting elderly. Because Senate financial disclosure rules do not require Hillary Clinton to reveal exactly how much or for what the company was paid, her husband over the past 5 years, we don't know all the details, but we do know this, former presidents, especially Bill Clinton, don't come cheap. And just months after he left the presidency, Bill Clinton was paid $200,000 for a speech given to InfoUSA in Omaha. Since then, he's been paid an undisclosed amount each year, listed only as more than $1,000 for non-employee compensation on Senator Clinton's Senate financial disclosure form. According to the New York Times, InfoUSA compiled and sold lists that disclosed the names of elderly men and women who would be likely to respond to unscrupulous scams. The list left no doubt about the vulnerability of the elderly targets. The Times reported, for example, that InfoUSA advertised list of elderly opportunity seekers, 3.3 million older people looking for ways to make money, and suffering seniors, 4.7 million people with cancer or Alzheimer's disease. Oldies but goodies contained a half a million gamblers over 55 years old for 8.5 cents apiece. One list says these people are gullible. They want to believe that their luck can change. The article goes on to comment that the Clintons spent $16 million on a Millennium New Year's Eve bash. Really? Imagine how many children could have been raised in villages for $16 million. The greedy are all alike. Americans will be hearing more about this story. They will need to consider the possibility that the sale of the names of credulous old people looks like a dress rehearsal for what could happen to them. And now our comments for the week ahead. The subject our guest today will delve into is the theocons and their nasty ways. using faith as a handle on power. You've probably noticed how successful they are at stealing using government and religion. Before we get into that, here are some things to consider about that spiritual journey that we call life. We're born, we live, and then we die. In the middle, we experience things through the framework of our rational minds and through the understanding our emotions provide. Despite what you hear, emotions and rationality are not oppositional. Our ancient ancestors were great observers. They also respected their emotions. They had to. Those saber-toothed tigers were fast. Fear makes you run. You don't wait around to analyze your probable chances of survival when confronted with an immediate threat. The strength of emotion supercharges your reactions. But remembering and analyzing allowed women to understand the use of herbs for medicinal purposes and for flavoring the food they began cooking for their children. The focus of woman is reproduction and babies, and that drove innovation. Then as now, innovation was the wellspring of wealth. Gathering and preserving food for those times when you couldn't gather because you were pregnant or had just given birth enabled our species to survive. Passing on knowledge generation to generation, mother to daughter, was the first form of wisdom and wealth. Don't kid yourself. Daddy was not in the picture. Men were hunters and did little else. Our ancestors survived because they, as women, cooperated, observed, and innovated. As a result, the genders developed different neurological characteristics. Women use their whole brains and thus can better multitask. Today, this is obvious from brain scans. If this had not been the case, we might not be here today. Today, we better understand, though still faintly, the neurological connections between the rational mind and emotion. Science is still nervous about the other component of our makeup, the spiritual. Those ancient ancestors sensed the spiritual component each of us carry within. They didn't question it. They just accepted it. The ancient god of spirituality celebrated continuation, fertility, and the connection to spirit that joined us past death. It didn't change much over 20,000 years, by all indications. And then, enter theology. When ideas are hijacked, it's amazing how they change. The ancient goddess worship was hijacked by the rise of theological viewpoints using pressure and arguments that allowed for the grabbing of wealth beginning around 6,000 years ago. Surprise! Those religions were run by men. Theology asks you to replace your own expertise with faith in what? The priests who represent the God incarnate, they say. The whole history of theology and government is an attempt to grab the power that individuals create materially and experience spiritually and convert it into a theology that gives control to the greedy and unproductive. The recent rise of science and rationality, with all its problems and abuses, was a real setback for the lowest end folks who wanted to continue to argue themselves into control using theology. For a while, they were frustrated. And then they set about using the Bible and revisionist history to grab back control. You have to give them credit for the magnitude of their ambition and for their ingenuity. Those are, of course, the theocons. They deny the usefulness of rationality vociferously, just like rationalists deny the existence of a spiritual component they can't measure. At the same time, they attack all other spiritual viewpoints. They have to. Any other viewpoint threatens their power. The theocons and neocons found a natural coalition around 30 years ago. They both use ideas to steal. Both groups are focused on power, money, and getting sex. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Ideas are powerful. Ideas misused are positively dangerous. Through all of that, we remain as God made us. We're here to learn and discover what the spiritual journey means to each of us individually and to come together voluntarily as we were directed to do without the use of deceit, coercion, or violence. Therefore, all of the greed people are a problem we need to understand and handle. If you live in America today, you have to be aware of the presence of the greed people. the loud ones in government and the loud of faith who assert vociferously that only they know the truth. When you examine the bottom line, the real truth is obvious. Those people of loud faith never let their eyes stray far from the prophet. By their fruit shall you know that. Remember that as we consider the state of the world, faith, and the hunger of humanity for freedom and justice today. Our guest today is Colonel David Antoon. The colonel graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy in 1970 and served nearly three tours of duty in Vietnam. During his tours of duty in that war zone, he received three Air Medals, the Distinguished Flying Cross, and the Meritorious Service Medal. He retired from the Air Force in the early 90s and now flies a 747 for a major airline. He has received two graduate degrees and has lived in the Middle East and has traveled extensively around the world. His last job before retiring was oversight of part of the construction of the B-2 bomber. In the early 80s, Colonel Antoon became a father. He and his wife, Linda, a former Air Force major and neonatal ICU nurse, have four children, and it was fatherhood that made him revisit the issues he had encountered while first in the military. Those issues brought him to confront national policy, the use of war to subsidize corporations, how our money is spent, and many, many other things. He was also forced to confront the role of the theocons in politics today. Will we continue to tolerate a genocide in our midst? What can a father do to stop it? What can a father do when that genocide is distorting the world for the children that he loves? With Colonel Antoon, we're going to confront that and many other questions this evening. Please welcome David Antoon. David, are you there?
I am here.
Well, I can hear you. That's a good thing.
And thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us today. And, you know, we always begin the show by asking our guests to tell us something about themselves. And I know that you had a very interesting growing up.
That's right. I grew up in the military as the son of in a military family. I have two brothers and a sister, and we lived in many different places. One of the most formative places was Tripoli, Libya, in the late 50s and early 60s. I attended junior high school there, and my father was a fluent Arabic speaker, and it was a fabulous assignment. The education I got there watching my father use his language skills, he spoke five languages, not just Arabic, but that Arabic was his first language, and it was an education in itself. One of the things I shared with you a few weeks ago was I remember we had a houseboy named Faturi, who was a young man, I would guess, probably in his early 20s. And I remember my father sitting with Faturi at our dining room table every evening for several months. And Faturi had the Quran in front of him, and my father, who had been raised Catholic, had the Bible in front of him. And they went through chapter by chapter of each book comparing. And it was, although I didn't understand the discourse between the two of them, my father would interrupt now and then and explain things to us. And the vague memory I have of that is there was so little difference, really. At that time, the Arab world loved Americans because we were not the French and we were not the British.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, we had not. We were not part of the empire that had come in and divided the resources of the Middle East between those two major powers. We had come in and were somewhat neutral at that point. This is, again, the late 50s. So that was probably the beginning of my education on Middle East issues. And it didn't begin again until after I came back from Vietnam. And I remember my daughter, who is now 23, coming home in fourth grade, and I, as most parents do, would say, "What did you do today? What did you learn in school today?" And my daughter said to me, "Well, I learned about the Holocaust." And I said, "Well, that's great, Emily. Did you talk about any other genocides?" And she said, "No." So that was my opportunity to sit with my daughter, and I had not, Vietnam was not that far back at that point for me, and I had flown many missions in Cambodia. The last part of the war, most of my missions were in Cambodia, and the killing fields had, I think at that point, made its way onto the movie screen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shared with her that there were many genocides, even in more modern times, that we all needed to be aware of.
And that was important to you. You wanted your kids to absolutely know about the world that they lived in.
Right. And I think my daughter, who is one of these people, all of my kids are very smart, but my daughter is passionate about social issues and anthropology and history, and she became fascinated with these issues and began a focus on Middle East issues, which has carried her to where she is today.
Mm-hmm. And the experiences that you had, sometimes we don't think about how we're going to be impacted by the experiences we're having when we're kids. But you had another experience with your father when you were overseas with the same houseboy, right?
That's correct. There was a point when my father was at work, and I think it must have been in the afternoon because I had come home from school, and a vendor was trying to purchase some trunks that we had used for moving. I don't know why he had come into the house for what purpose, but he saw the trunks and he wanted to buy them. And my mother said they were not for sale, and he insisted that he buy them and started actually putting money down. And I think my mother's voice must have sounded distressed because our houseboy came in and pushed this gentleman out of our house and out of our compound, whereupon there was some fisticuffs thrown. And the next thing that happened was Petrie was hauled off to jail at the local jailhouse. So when my father came home, he went. He heard the story from my mom, and he went down to the police station and walked in, and immediately my father was referred to in Arabic as a dirty Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, my father spoke fluent Arabic. He spoke the king's dialect, really, and in perfect Arabic, he turned to the gentleman who had said that and to the policeman and said, "What makes you think I'm a Christian? Why do you think I'm not Muslim?" And the story related back to me was that the policeman's eyes got very, very large at that point because they did not expect my father in an Air Force uniform to be speaking fluent Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, again, this was his first language, not his second language.
Yeah.
It took only a few minutes for the use of the language to disarm the situation, and our houseboy was home, back home safely with us.
Mm-hmm. Well, they must have been hideously embarrassed that they had revealed themselves in front of an American officer.
Yes.
But also, what it did is it taught them a lesson about their assumptions that they make about people.
Exactly. And that was a very unusual event. At the time, we were there for over 3 years, and it was a wonderful experience. And I think that was the only tense moment there was that we were ever involved in. It was a very friendly environment. The people were really wonderful. So I have great respect for the Arab culture because of that.
Mm-hmm.
It really was a wonderful experience.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, now we're seeing it vilified, which is simply horrifying.
It is terrible. One other story that I'd like to relate about how small the world is I wrote an article before the war started called The Pain of War, and it ended up being published on the internet, and I received a call or an email from a woman in Phoenix, Arizona named Rana. I will not say her last name. And Rana related to me. She thanked me for writing the story, and in the discussion we had, she mentioned that she had lived in Tripoli, Libya. She was the daughter of Palestinian refugees who had moved from Lebanon to the Saudi oil fields, where her father was a petroleum engineer, and then to Tripoli, Libya. And this was when we were in Tripoli, Libya. King Idris was in power. They had a monarchy, and of course,
mm-hmm.
monarchies, as they are today, were pretty much puppet governments of the United States. And this was right before Muammar Gaddafi overthrew King Idris in a bloodless coup. But Rana shared with me her pain of war, and that was that she was a college student in the late 80s attending college in London, and she roomed with her cousin Sappho, who also her parents lived in Tripoli also, and they were home for Easter weekend that year, and Rana returned one day earlier than Sappho, and the night that Rana left to return to London was the night that our F-111 bombed Tripoli. And one of those bombs hit their apartment and killed Sappho.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah, it is a very small world. My daughter took courses in Lebanon several years ago, went to an intensive language program at Lebanon American University. And Rana's mother still lives in Beirut. They moved to, after that bombing, they left Libya and moved to Beirut, back
mm-hmm.
to Beirut. And Rana's mother looked after my daughter while my daughter was attending school there. So it's a very small world.
Oh, it is. Very, very small world. And your whole life has illustrated a lot of interesting things that you obviously sort of tapped into to sort of change the way that you look at the world.
Yes.
And for instance, your experience in the military, I think, sort of laid the groundwork for a lot of the changes that were later to take place in your viewpoint, right?
That's correct. I think this is true for most people, but for me it had a little bit different flavor. I didn't get married until I was 35, so I had a lot of years single, and where one can be quite selfish and self-indulgent. But once you have a wife and children, your whole perspective changes. And when we moved to Ohio, I lived in a rural area initially, well, for several years actually, and the schools were very, very rural and poor. The teachers were underpaid. And I ended up moving from a pilot job in the test wing to the B-2 bomber program office, where I worked as a program manager on the crew station. And the amount of money on that program was so phenomenal. It was enough to buy, I think, a new school for every school district in the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I quickly learned how the Defense Department works and how acquisition works from the political perspective. You know, I think the people who work the programs at the grassroots level, the people like me, you work on your piece of it, you do the best you can, and you don't really understand what the senior managers and corporate minders are doing. In this case, they put a piece of this airplane in every congressional district. So when the need for the aircraft went away, it was the purpose of the aircraft was to go after relocatable targets in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Soviet Union fell, the program did not stop.
And you had an expectation that they would probably scrap it then, right?
Well, I did, because there was no need for it at that point. And then what happened is Reagan was leaving office. There was a mad rush for political purposes to have first flight before Reagan left office.
Mm-hmm.
This was under his watchful eye that this corporate program grew to such massive dollar levels. And I think they ended up making 24 airplanes, and the last I heard from a recent source was that the cost per unit worked out to about $2.2 billion per copy.
That's say that again.
$2.2 billion
per plane.
Right, because they produce so few of them. And the developmental costs of this very, very high-tech weapon were distributed over those few airplanes. So,
that's a mind-boggling amount of money.
Well, it is, and then when they use them, it's almost laughable, because The first Gulf War and this war we're currently in, they flew them over, I think, once, did a nonstop from the only base in the United States that has this airplane, Whiteman Air Force Base, Missouri, and flew them nonstop, hitting tankers several times going over and several times going back, coming back. The crew's sleeping in lawn chairs, believe it or not. And they drop their ordnance, and then they return, and then there's a big press release about what the B-2 bomber did. It's just almost laughable. I mean, that's a lot. That's an awfully expensive weapon system to make one trip to drop their bombs to get the press release, and then they're not used again.
Well, and if you take a look at the companies that made the profit, and you take a look at the relationship between that and the donations they make to people's campaign funds and their presidential libraries and through other mediums into their pockets, it becomes so painfully obvious what's really going on there. It's just simply mind-boggling when you think about that amount of money being simply flushed down the toilet.
Right. And of course, now this has gone to a new level, as I shared in an earlier conversation with you, with the Blackwater contractor, Eric Prince, a strident evangelical who's tied in with the Bush administration, who contracts mercenaries for this war. He now has three major military installations, the one in North Carolina being, I think, 17,000 acres, one in Illinois and one out on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
This is a private contractor with military bases this large and contracting, according to Jeremy Scahill, the author, approximately 125,000 mercenaries for this war. And we're not talking the cooks and the truck drivers, we're talking mercenaries, the guys you see guarding Ambassador Bremer when he was there, and whenever our representatives, if you wish to call them that, in Washington go to the Middle East, they're guarded by these mercenaries.
Well, and that's illegal.
Well, yes, it is. And you know, the mercenaries that they first hired for Blackwater were former soldiers, guys getting off of active duty or who had been out for a while and looking for fast and big money. But Blackwater has now, as so many other corporations, has outsourced these jobs. They're now going to Central America. They're hiring for a dime on the dollar, so to speak, soldiers trained at the School of the Americas, and sending them to Iraq. They've gone to Pinochet's disappearing goon squads and hired those folks as part of this mercenary group. They've gone to South Africa, and they've gone to Israel. In fact, during the Katrina operation, there were Blackwater contractors in New Orleans that had Israeli citizenship holding guns on U.S. citizens. I mean, it is out of control.
It is. The whole thing is bizarre. And, of course, when you talk about Blackwater, people need to understand that this is very much a theocon-related operation.
Yes, absolutely. One of the points that relates to the evangelical issues in the military, which of course I'm so very familiar with, is a fellow named Joe Schmitz, who was the DOD Inspector General, who was involved in the Boeing contractor deal, the Boeing refueler, where the Air Force was going to lease a number of airplanes at a cost greater than purchasing them outright. One of the biggest corporate welfare scams ever, which was, if it hadn't been for John McCain, would have been, not that I'm a fan of John McCain's, but if not for John McCain blowing the whistle on that, it may have gone through. Joe Schmitz gave that his stamp of approval. He was the one who investigated Jerry Boykin for his evangelical activities in uniform on Sunday mornings, going around as a two-star general, saying his God was better than their God. I don't remember the exact quote. He was the one who investigated the Air Force Academy and said, no problem here. He is now an executive with Blackwater.
So he made a move.
He made a move. And
after having lined the little nest for himself.
Yes, yes. So, you know, he's very handsomely paid. But this is, it's no longer just a financial issue to the taxpayer. It's now a huge moral issue as to what is going on with American power American empire, which the reason I am here with you now is to try and inform the American public what is really going on, because most people just don't know.
Well, they don't, and they don't see it in the major media, of course. And they have no idea that behind the, you know, the behind the scenes, there's this collusion going on between the people that we've come to know as the theocons, which represent a very, very minor sect, you know, in of religion, who've managed to actually grow themselves out in ways that nobody could have possibly anticipated, because they've actually reversed the whole direction of social justice in America.
One of the other issues that has been something that I've gotten involved in is the recruiting efforts in the high schools. And again, we go back to my children, because without my children, I would not be aware of so much of this. My daughter has educated me. My sons have educated me, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not. With my oldest son, just before the war started, they landed three Black Hawk helicopters at the high school and came into the high school during the lunch hour and put up a chin-up bar and asked the kids to do the Marine Challenge. How many pull-ups can you do? And, of course, when you have these budding young men with more testosterone in their brains, there's nothing they would like to do more than impress the young ladies. So immediately the football players were up trying to do their pull-ups, and I'm not sure anybody there did 20, and one of the kids was poking my son to go do his pull-ups. And here's my son, who is 6'4", who has these extremely long arms, and you would never think with that kind of arm length you'd be able to do pull-ups. But Ryan is a technical rock climber, and he's extremely strong. And Ryan went up and did 44 pull-ups with two fingers.
Wow.
And he came home with his Marine T-shirt, which he was quite proud of. But it started another interesting thread in my life, because the telephone started ringing frequently with recruiters after my son. I had two young female Marine recruiters in Class A uniforms, good-looking young ladies, show up at our door on a Saturday morning to recruit my son. I had phone calls that said U.S. government on the caller ID, but when I queried the caller, they said they were Mr. So-and-so. And I said, Mr., why do you want to talk to my son? He says, well, I'm a recruiter. I said, you're a recruiter and you're a mister, you're not a sergeant? And I learned from these folks when they discussed it with me that our government has contracted out recruiting now to supplement what the active duty folks are doing, and it's a matter of bounty hunters. These folks get $1,000 per head, and then if they can do extra pull-ups and they can fly airplanes, and they're captain of the hockey team.
So you found out how much your son was worth to the government.
Yeah. There's a bonus here for them. I wrote the recruiting service and asked them not to call my house anymore. And, you know, Ryan was very fond of the military. He had planned on going into the military. And this was, I think, what you alluded to, where I was finally forced to confront these issues with my children. And especially Ryan, because he was the one who, since an early age, had wanted to follow in his father's footsteps, as most sons do, as most firstborn sons do. And Ryan worked very hard. He was a strong academically and had done as many extracurricular things as any kid could ever do. And he received an appointment to the Air Force Academy. And when he received that, he was on cloud nine, because this was his sole goal in life. And when I got home and we read the letter, they said there was an orientation at the Air Force Academy. And I said, Ryan, do you want to go to visit the Air Force Academy for the orientation? Actually, I think I said, you don't really want to go to the Air Force Academy for the orientation, because he's been out there so many times for the force camps. And he said, yeah, of course, Dad, I want to go out there. So off we went. And that was a time, a visceral event in my life, because I witnessed what had transpired since I had graduated there in 1970. There are 34 years difference from when I started the academy and when Ryan would have. 38 years. And what else here? We were faced two very significant things. One was the Commandant of Cadets, General Wida, who strutted back and forth on the stage with one theme, which was being a warrior. When I was there, the theme was leadership. We're training
mm-hmm.
leaders for our military. You will be general officers. You will be leaders. And if you don't stay in the military, you will be leaders for America. That is not there anymore. Now the theme is we are training warriors. And I didn't quite understand that till the middle of the day when we were sent off to the chapel, and I faced a row of evangelical preachers, only evangelical preachers. There was not a mainline Protestant there. There was not a priest. There was not a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
There were approximately a dozen evangelicals lined up shoulder to shoulder. And the leader of the group was Chaplain Watiz, who had been the Air Force Chaplain of the year before. And if you read the press releases of that time, boasted about baptizing soldiers in Saddam Hussein's swimming pool. This was his great accomplishment in life, was baptizing people in Saddam Hussein's swimming pool. And he looked at this group of Air Force cadets or Air Force candidates who had received their appointments to the academy, and he said this. He said, "We have almost half the cadet wing attending Bible studies in the dormitories on Monday nights, and with your group, we hope to increase those numbers."
And that's not exactly the sort of thing one expects to hear about at the Air Force Academy.
No, you know, I at that point I realized that it was no longer the Air Force Academy; it was Rocky Mountain Bible College. And then keep in mind when the investigation of all the events out there, which occurred after that point, happened, the DODIG said it was only an image issue; they had done nothing wrong. General Wida was silenced. He was removed from the promotion list and then secretly promoted with back pay a year later.
That sends a very strong message about what's really going on.
General Boykin, who was a two-star and was chastised in the media for a very brief period of time, and I think the media was told to lay off by the powers in Washington, he later became head of intelligence for the army, and he was in charge of the prisons. He was in charge of rendition. Here's this evangelical, so-called self-indulgent Christian who is running torture camps, renditioning people to be tortured around the world. This is the same General Jerry Boykin who was then promoted to 3 stars. And of course, there's the Christian Embassy and the Christian Embassy video with General Caslin and General Vincent Brooks, the voice of the forces in Qatar, the general officer who I don't know whether he actually fabricated the story of Pat Tillman's fratricide or covered it up, made him a hero, and turned Jessica Lynch into a Rambo image for the American media for. You know, the manipulation of these people is so sad.
It's actually, you can almost look at it as revisionist history in the making. You mentioned the Christian Embassy, and I know what it is, but could you just tell people exactly what this institution is and how
it's an organization in Washington it's like a cancer, because what they've done is they've worked their way into the bowels of the government. They are actually eating and holding prayer meetings and secret meetings in the inner dining room where the Secretary of Defense is. And General Caslin, in the Christian Embassy video, which they had as one of their promotional videos until we pointed out to the public that this was going on, claimed that they were the aroma of Jesus Christ. And then General Caslin moved from there to be made the Commandant of Cadets at West Point.
They continue to do this, right? They find somebody who cooperates with them, who really buys on,
right.
And then no matter that they're not qualified, they continue to be moved up.
Yes. General Vincent Brooks was also, both of these people have now been promoted to 2 stars in spite of the embarrassment of these things. And you know, in my day, back in the days when we had, instead of, you know, at the Air Force Academy now they have 18 active duty chaplains plus 25 reserve chaplains assigned to the Air Force Academy. They have a chaplain assigned to every sports team. And when I was at the Air Force Academy, we had 3 mainline Protestants, we had 2 priests, and we had 1 rabbi. We didn't have a chaplain assigned to every sports team. And the antics of General Wyda and General Caslin, Jerry Boykin, these people would have been given Section 8 discharges 2 decades ago.
So you're saying that they're crazy, and you mean it?
Well, their behavior is bizarre, and they certainly should not be in charge of people and people's lives.
Well, and they're in charge of people at a juncture in their life when they're extremely vulnerable.
Right.
And they know that, and that's, of course, why there's so many of them there. There's a method to their madness, so to speak.
Right. So, anyway, these are the issues that have been so formative for me, because I'm looking at my son, who's dedicated his life to getting into the Air Force Academy, and now I'm seeing what the Air Force Academy is now.
Mm-hmm.
It is, and I had to sit down with my son and tell him. I said, Ryan, this is not the same institution that I attended, and you must not make a decision to go there because Dad went there. This is your decision to make. I will support you no matter what you do, but you must understand this is not the same institution. I cannot suggest you go here anymore. I'm bothered by what I've witnessed at the Air Force Academy.
And you didn't want him vulnerable. You didn't want him vulnerable in a lot of different ways. And, of course, as has happened to other, you know, sons who went into the service, some of them, of course, don't come out. They die. They die in Iraq. But also, you didn't want him to be morally vulnerable.
Right. You know, one of the things I shared with Ryan when I sat down with him when he had to make this decision was that, you know, Ryan's goal was to be a fighter pilot in the Air Force, and that's an admirable goal. However, you have to look at reality of where we are now with the United States government. And I told Ryan, I said, we have not had a dogfight for several decades. Our high-tech military has not been used for defense. It has been used to bomb third-world villages. You know, brown-skinned people in third-world villages. I mean, what kind of defense is there that we're using our airplanes for?
Well, it's certainly not defense.
It's not defense. It's offense. It's all offense. That was the moral issue I had to share with my son. And I told him, I said, I will support you no matter what you do, but this is the issue. Can you, at this point, at age 18, what a terrible situation to put your son of 18 years old in, to say, here's the after for years setting a goal to get an appointment to one of the military institutions in our country, one of the 3 major military institutions, receive the appointment, and then have his father say, Ryan, now you have to look and make this decision. I felt that was where I failed as a father, because I never confronted this until I witnessed what I did witness at the Air Force Academy. And then I had to share with my son, who I love dearly, what my perceptions were, what my reality was, based upon my years of experience and what I witnessed during that one day at the Air Force Academy as to what was going on.
Well, it wasn't a failure on your part. I mean, you didn't know to what extent it had changed, and you only came to realize it then.
Well, I think I came to realize it because it was so blatant. But I think if I had read more and done more self-education, I might have been more aware of what was going on. But, of course, you know, our country, it's also about that time, obviously, the information about Abu Ghraib had come out.
Mm-hmm.
Rendition was starting to be known about. The lack of WMDs and all the other things that have put our country in such a horrible, horrible downfall. We're starting to become aware of that. But, you know, again, looking back, and the signs were there. You know, Seymour Hersh did the article about Abu Ghraib. He was the one that broke the story in The New Yorker. But, you know, Seymour Hersh also was the one who broke the story about My Lai.
Yes,
these sorts of things existed in Vietnam also, but I think it was easier to ignore and say that it was an isolated incident. But it wasn't. The more you read, the more you find out, none of these things were really isolated incidents. They were one of many.
The pattern of secrecy is also extremely troubling.
Right.
Because that's been there, you know, for a long time, and the secrecy has enabled this sort of thing to continue to happen and to escalate, which is what I think you're saying, right?
Right, right. And you know what? The other thing, you know, I talk about how my kids have educated me. And, you know, I have to say that my children have educated me probably much more than I have educated them. Because when I was in the throes of helping Ryan with this decision or supporting him with whatever decision he made, my daughter said to me, she was more than happy that Ryan had decided not to go into the military. And she pointed out, she says, Dad, you know, the military has always been glamorized. And you take that statement from your daughter, and then you think about it for a while, and you go, wow. Yes, absolutely. Madison, Fifth Avenue, advertising agencies, multi-million-dollar efforts to recruit kids. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It is glamorized. But we never stop and really think about that.
Well, they tend to get people involved in the military when they're really too young to make an informed decision that way. In many cases, they make the decision before you'd let them have a credit card, and they're putting their life on the line, too.
Right. Yeah, as you know from one of our previous discussions, the No Child Left Behind Act, which is written up in the Education Code, most Americans are aware of the No Child Left Behind Act, but they only see the face of it being holding administrators and schools accountable for standards of education, which also has its failures because it's not exactly what it's trumped up to be. But written into the Education Code, is the recruiting in the high schools by our military. It authorizes and actually demands that recruiters be given access to our high schools. And many recruiters have offices in the high schools. And what I found, again, in my efforts to educate myself about the recruiting efforts was that the recruiters were in the high school, they were authorized by the Education Code to be there, and they had access to our kids' records.
Mm-hmm.
And they data mined our kids' records and sent it off to a multi-million-dollar contractor in Washington called JMARS, Joint Marketing and Research System, or I'm not sure what the last letter stands for, but this organization is a multi-hundred-million-dollar-plus operation data mining our kids' data, and they use it for recruiting efforts.
Yes, the whole process of doing that is not so that they can teach them, you know, better basket-making skills.
Of course.
And how many of them, of course, end up dying? How many of them end up, when they come back, damaged, simply abandoned?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, those numbers are going to be growing exponentially here in the next several years, depending on how long this war goes. But even if the war stopped today, those numbers are going to be growing at an exponential rate for some time to come, as all the psychological and other damages that these young kids come to light.
Mm-hmm. And your kids have, you made a point of taking your kids to Palestine at one point.
Yes, we took our kids to Jerusalem this past Christmas, and it was the trip of a lifetime for the education it offered, and you'll understand that as I get into the story. We stayed inside the old city walls of Jerusalem for about 3 days, and we went to Bethlehem. And to get to Bethlehem is now surrounded on three sides by the apartheid 30-foot wall, which is just horrible. It is so oppressive. Jimmy Carter is more than accurate in calling it an apartheid wall. It is apartheid. But you have to go through the checkpoint to get into the village of Bethlehem. And going through those checkpoints and seeing that wall and being threatened by Israeli soldiers when we tried to take a picture of the wall was probably the greatest education I've ever given my children. They can see what apartheid is. And when they read about it, when they discuss it, they have a first-hand, visceral vision of what it is. And so I was probably the greatest gift I've ever given my children.
And you've given them a tremendous number of gifts that way. You've given them a real clarity that most people don't develop until they're much older. So, you know, I don't think you're a failure as a father. I think you're a great father.
Well, that has been a shared journey. As I've said, I've learned so much from my children. My children have educated me as much as I've educated them. I guess I'm very fortunate in being able to say that. But we have a lot of exchanges. We have a lot of heated exchanges. But it's an education for all of us.
And I know that being a father became sort of very central to your life, very much something that enriched and gave your life a focus that's, sort of been life-changing.
Absolutely. And you know, the Bekovich story of the past few weeks, Professor Bekovich at Boston University, his son dying on Mother's Day, we share so many similarities. He was a West Point graduate a few years after I graduated from the Air Force Academy. He had tours in Vietnam. I had tours in Vietnam. We both had children late, although I had them later than he did. And here we are, 4 decades later.
Yes, and here you did one thing, and he made another choice,
right.
And his son's dead, and yours is alive.
Right. And it's not that I did anything right. It's just that I saw things a little bit differently than he did. The decision of discouraging my son in a way of attending the Air Force Academy was a very, very difficult decision.
Oh, I know it must have been
and
for you.
I look at the decision that the senior Andrew Bekovich made, and I know. I mean, he too is understands empire and how things have gone so off course in this country.
Yes. Well,
and he wrote about them. I mean, he has a book he wrote a year ago, and yet his son went through the ROTC program and got a commission in the Army, and I know his father must have been tormented in a different way than I was.
Mm-hmm.
But he has lost everything.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, I grieve for this man. I really feel bad for him.
Well,
I
yes, because he's going to be living with this for the rest of his life. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah,
you should, you know, and I'm going to hear soon that you have written a book about your life because it's one that needs to be told.
Yeah.
And I want to thank you for sharing time with us today. We're going to have to, you know, bring the program to an end. But I want to thank you so much for sharing your life because it's been such an eloquent one.
Well, thank you very much.
But and
again,
God,
all my credit goes to my family.
I know. Will you take care and God bless, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Melinda. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's our show for today, Friday, June 1st, 2007. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that when any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that will bring us to freedom, and may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.